Today's scripture reading is from the book of Acts, the 15th chapter, the second verse. Paul and Barnabas took sides against these Judeans and argued strongly against their position. The church at Antioch appointed Paul, Barnabas, and several others from Antioch to go up to Jerusalem to set this question before the apostles and the elders. This is the word of God for the people of God.
Thank you, Jack. And good morning again, friends. We are continuing a sermon series called Reclaimed. And reclaiming something is all that's super popular right now. There's all sorts of TV shows about it. You've probably seen, Chip and Joanna's show. What's that one called? Fixer Upper. Someone is a watcher. Fixer Upper. We see people who are reclaiming people's lives and their fashion, and shows like Queer Eye that are getting more and more popularity on Netflix. You see all sorts of different projects and different people, and we're fascinated with this idea of going and taking things of the past and renewing them and taking the best of them and maybe putting a little coat of paint on something and making it new for going forward from that point. I love the idea of reclaimed. But I especially like reclaiming something when I'm working alone. I brought a chair out last week, and it was a project that I got to do on my own. I decided the direction I was going to take it in. I decided the fabric. I decided the stain color that I was going to do. When you're doing a project, when you're reclaiming something on your own, you get to do whatever you want to do. And yet, I've found in my life that for the most part, when I'm working with change, when I'm making things new, whenever I have some say in something, it's rarely solo. It's rarely just me. Most of the time, I have to work with other people. And I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but when you work with other people, they have ideas too. It's very frustrating sometimes. One example of this, I was talking to my mom and stepdad about a year ago. And by the way, I shared about my stepdad getting open heart surgery this week. And thank you for the prayers and for the messages and the support. He is doing fantastic. He had some scares this week, and it was a little more complicated than they thought, but he is healing and he's recovering and he's doing well. And so I am so relieved. It just feels like a weight off of my shoulders. So thank you all for your support. But his name is Tom. So my mom and Tom, they were deciding that they wanted to reclaim and renovate the inside of their home. They decided that they had this old living room, this old kitchen, and they decided that they wanted to go and reclaim and renovate this part of their home. And so about 6 months after that, I ended up calling them up and I said, "Hey, how's the project coming?" They said, "We haven't started yet." I said, "Oh, are you having trouble with change? Is change something that's hard for you?" And they said, "No, we're excited about the project. We're excited about change. We just have different ideas of what we want." And so this is actually what ended up getting them to take a while to make these decisions, to make any improvements, to go in that direction, is because they had two people had different ideas about what they wanted. Who knew that is what would happen? I often, when it comes to churches, when it comes to people, I sometimes have carried this kind of bias that I've always thought that people are afraid of change or that people don't like change. And I don't think that's true at all. In fact, after years of working with people, I think people like the idea of change. I think people like the idea of change. But not only is this true, I think there's a truer way to understand this, and it's by adding two letters to this phrase. The I and the R. People like their idea of change. And that is what I've come to realize, that it's not change that people have problems with. It's that we don't necessarily change things like they should change. And so eventually I ended up calling mom and my stepdad, and they had finally made some progress. And I was like, "How did you guys figure it out? How did you figure out what you wanted to do? How did you eventually stack hands and move forward?" And Tom said, "No, I realized that I was wrong." And so we just went with what my mom wanted. Some of you, that is how you move forward. Sometimes there's this, when it comes to different ideas of how we change, You just get told no, and you say yes to one person's idea. Sometimes, though, you meet a middle ground. Sometimes you collaborate. Sometimes you give and you take a little bit. Like this, but we often in life we have to figure out how we move forward together, how we change, what things we renovate. This isn't just about furniture or houses or renovation projects. We see this all over the world. If you think about this concept and you bring it to 10,000 feet, we see it everywhere. We see it. This is the material that makes wars start, is you have different nations that have different ideas of what the future looks like and what changes they want to happen in the world. And when they disagree and they can't agree on what those changes look like and how they benefit everyone, we get to a point where eventually it escalates to wars if they can't figure it out. That is what conflict is. It's about people who have different ideas of what change looks like. And this isn't just... This is also in wars. This happens with divorces. You have people who cannot reconcile their differences and their ideas about what their marriage is supposed to look like. You have this frustration when that new management comes into your workplace and they have a different idea for the future than you have the idea for a future. And if you can't reconcile that, it gets to the point where you turn in a resignation letter because you do not want to be going in the same direction that organization is going anymore. This happens for governments, for businesses, for organizations, for families, for romances, for friendships. If you have any group of people that's more than one, you will have at some point a challenge in figuring out shared trajectory for where you want to go when you change things. By the way, we see this in politicians. We vote on the person who we think that we has the better ideas of what change should look like. And we even label our political parties this. When we talk about something that is conservative, to conserve something, which means to keep the traditions of the past, to conserve the things that worked for us. It's a little bit resilient to the idea of change. Don't change too much. The idea of something being liberal. Liberal means to be generous. And so that you have an attitude, a political attitude, that is then to be more embracive of change. And so then you have, end up, what you feel there, that tension that we have so much in our society is actually a tension about how we handle change. What changes do we feel comfortable with? We have different ideas of what that looks like. Being in a relationship with any size group of people means that sometimes you'll have different ideas of where you're going. And so then the question is, for anybody who's breathing and living and walking around this world and interacting with any size group of people, the question is, how do you get a bunch of different people to stack hands and agree on something? How do you do it? Well, to tackle this question, I want to bring us back to where we left off last week in the first century. And last week, if you were with us, we talked about how Jesus arrived on the scene with the people of Israel, with this Jewish nation that had been conquered by Rome. And so these Jewish people that Jesus arrived on the scene with, and Jesus was Jewish, and his ministry was initially to just Jewish people. And so what Jesus ended up doing was talking about where they were going as a nation. But these people didn't want to go somewhere forward, they wanted to go back to the good old days. And so this was challenging, and Jesus' message was really challenging for people in the first century. And a lot of the people that he came to help turned away from his message. And so Christianity started as this very small movement, and then over the years, after Jesus died, resurrected, and ascended, the early Christian movement began to spread and snowball and got more and more momentum in those first years and started to spread not only into Israel, but up into what we see as like modern day Europe and down into North Africa, and we see the Christian movement spread across the known world. This was amazing and this was exciting, and often when we think about this early Christian movement, we think that they had it all together, that they knew exactly what they were supposed to do. Some of these people met Jesus. Some of them were their leaders were the early apostles. They would have stories to tell that none of us have ever had access to. You would think that it would be perfect, that it would be a little bit of heaven on earth. But the truth is that Jesus didn't leave any guide to how to do church. Jesus taught a lot of parables, talked a lot about the state of the human heart, talked about how you should love people, but didn't give us any book of discipline or any structure about how a church should exist. He talked about human relationships. He didn't talk about organizational ideas or organizational health or what churches should look like.
And so Christians had to decide all sorts of things. They decide there's this one controversy that happened in the early church by this guy named Marcion, who thought that Christians shouldn't be reading the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bibles, another way to talk about that, that they should just toss it out, that it has nothing to do with Jesus and nothing to do with the Christian faith. And so this was an early controversy, and so Christians ended up having to make a decision. Do we incorporate? Do we read the Hebrew Bible? Do we consider it a sacred scripture to us? And they ended up deciding yes, but not everybody was bought into that decision. Or what about the holy day? For us, we come to church on Sundays. But for thousands of years, people, the holy day was, their sacred day was Saturday. It started at sundown on Friday, and the Jews today, Jewish people today, still worship this way. The sun sets on Friday, that starts the Sabbath, and it ends when the sun sets on Saturday. That's the Sabbath period. And what we've done is we've moved to a different calendar system, and so it starts at midnight and it ends at midnight, and we have our Sundays. We pick so these early Christians had to decide. Jesus rose on a Sunday, so maybe we should move our holy day, maybe we should move our Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. This is one of the debates that they had to figure out. What day do we worship on? What day is our holy day? This is some of these are some of the easy ones, the silly, the ones that we never think about, but somebody somewhere had to agree that this is what we're going to do. Well, today we're going to talk about a conflict that has absolutely zero application to your life. I'm sure you've never heard that in a sermon before. This has zero application to your life. But it's not the topic of what they were having conflict over. It's how they handled it that I want to talk to you about. And so, as the early church was spreading and these little communities were forming of Christians who were meeting and following Jesus all over the known world, one of those communities happened in a place called Antioch. Antioch is 500 miles north of Jerusalem, so it's a little hall, and there are no cars, there's just caravans and boats and things like this, so it's a little bit of a hall away, but this was in modern-day Turkey. This is an area that didn't have a huge Jewish population, and so this was a church that was starting that was mostly Gentiles. Well, Paul and Barnabas, which was one of Paul's traveling companions, ended up traveling around up to different parts of the world and started these churches, and Paul had a heart for people who weren't Jewish. He wanted to invite Gentiles, the non-Jewish people, the people that were always seen as the outsiders. Paul had a heart for them and wanted to invite them into relationship with Christ and into this movement. And so Paul ended up going to this place called Antioch and ended up liking it and settling down there for a period of time. Paul and Barnabas both did. Now, when I talk about the Apostle Paul, some of you have preconceived notions about Paul. Some of you may not be super familiar with Paul. He ended up writing most of the New Testament, but Paul never actually met Jesus in the flesh. So it's one of those things. For us, it's the Paul. Paul's a big name in the church. But in the first century, it was probably a little closer to, oh yeah, Paul, one of many leaders. Oh yeah, Paul comes through and he writes once in a while. Because they would have a chance to meet Paul, but he hadn't become the Paul. Scripture hadn't been gathered. The New Testament didn't exist yet. They just had a handful of letters that were advice from one Christian leader. But there were lots of different Christian leaders. And so Paul was just one of many. And so Paul and Barnabas end up settling down in this town, Antioch, and working with this church and spending a little bit of time there and teaching and having a relationship with this Christian community. And then some other Christian leaders come to Antioch and start teaching and being involved. And they start teaching something very different from what Paul and Barnabas believe. And we have here a record of a big conflict that happened in Antioch that led to a larger church discussion about who we are and where we're going and what we reclaim and what we let go of and what we keep. And here's what it was about. Let's read it. It says this: some people came down from Judea teaching the family of believers, unless you are circumcised according to the custom we've received from Moses, you can't be saved. Paul and Barnabas took sides against these Judeans and argued strongly against their position. Now, up to this point, you might have come to church the last 4 weeks and thought, this new pastor, he's pretty cool. His sermons are okay. And now you read this and you're like, why is he talking about circumcision? This guy's super weird. So if this makes... If this makes you uncomfortable, if you're not sure what circumcision is, I want you to talk to Pastor Erica, and so she can help you out with that. This is why I said this has zero application to us now, because there is not a church in America that's going to require someone to get circumcision to become a Christian. This is a moot point. It means nothing to us now. This is one of those passages in the Bible that you read and you're like, what am I reading? I wish somebody would explain this to me. Well, we're going to unpack it a little bit, because this is a big deal to the first century Christians, because Jesus came out of the Jewish tradition, which meant that there was a group of Jewish Christians who would have thought that Christianity was an extension of Judaism, was not a new religion, was just an impassioned new way of living a Jewish life, and it was just a little more open, and so we were inviting Gentiles to become part of our Jewish faith. That is one way that some of these early Christians would have thought, and what would have happened is the debate would have originated because there was a group of people who were like, this is a tradition that I went through, and my father went through, and my father's father went through, and has been practiced for thousands of years, and all of a sudden we're letting Gentiles in here, and you're just going to throw tradition out? We're just going to toss it out like it doesn't matter? Where do we draw the line? This is a movement that Jesus started, but what are we going to do with all these traditions of the past? Are you telling me that the thing that has been important to my family for all these years, for thousands of years, we're just going to stop doing because somebody doesn't want to do it? And that is why it became a bigger argument. And so Paul and Barnabas couldn't convince the church entirely of their perspective, and the Judean leaders couldn't convince the church of their perspective, and so they had this conflict, and they couldn't agree on what they were going to keep and what they were going to leave behind in this Christian movement. And so the story continues, and it goes, and it says this: the church at Antioch appointed Paul, Barnabas, and several others from Antioch to go up to Jerusalem, so travel that 500 miles to go up to Jerusalem, and it's too small to read back there. All right, arrive Jerusalem to set this question before the apostles and elders. And when they arrived in Jerusalem, and by the way, this question before the apostles and elders, even in the earliest church, they had some systems and hierarchy. So it wasn't just every church for themselves. They said, well, let's send this to the people that are at the core of the Christian movement, and we'll have them decide and tell us what we should do, because we can't seem to decide it ourselves. And so they send it up the ladder to this Christian council in Jerusalem. And they gave a full report of what God had accomplished through their activity. And some believers from among the Pharisees stood up and claimed, and I love this, you could tell who's writing this down, because I don't know if necessarily the Jewish Pharisees actually had become Christians and had been part of their movement, or if they're just kind of like, they're just labeling, they're like, those Pharisees. Lost my voice. Stood up and claimed, the Gentiles must be circumcised. They must be required to keep the law from Moses. And the apostles and the elders gathered to consider this matter. From Acts 15. So this Jerusalem council ends up deciding and debating, what are we going to do with this? And I imagine that somebody on this council would kind of lean over to somebody else and say, oy vey, I didn't know what I was getting into when I signed up for this. What would my mother think? There's my terrible accent. Sorry, you can make fun of that later. So I'm sure that they did not think that they were going to be dealing with this kind of stuff. So pause on that. Leave it as a cliffhanger. I know you all want to know what happened here, but I want to bring us back here for a second. Something that I love about this story is, even though it's a weird topic, this is kind of how we do conflict and how we do decisions in the Methodist Church today. In some churches, a pastor is almost a little king. In some churches, a pastor gets to make the decisions. People just, you know, people are super respectful and let a pastor do what they want and look for the pastor's vision. The Methodist Church doesn't allow that to happen. And sometimes that's handy for a leader, because when you have just power that's not debated, you can help make decisions quicker. But you've all heard of controversies that have happened in churches because a pastor had too much power, which is why we are part of a denomination and a system that has different leadership councils. There's a new model of doing it, which we've incorporated here at our church, but we have a leadership council. Now, a leadership council, I don't even get to pick those people. A leadership council is formed because we have a nominations committee of people who are looking for leaders in our church who are generous and kind and wise and who live out their faith. And we lift these people up into a service that's, you know, a couple of years. It can be anywhere from 1 to 3 years. And these people help make decisions for us as a church, because a pastor shouldn't have total power. And so what ends up happening is that I have a relationship with the leadership council, and this is how we handle decisions as a church. We have a collaborative decision-making, just like the early church. I was actually having coffee with a pastor who goes to this church who shall not be named, who sits in the fourth row. And he helped me think through this a little bit, because I was asking all sorts of questions about, you know, how do I relate? How does the system work? How does the church make decisions? And trying to ask questions about this. And so this unnamed pastor ended up giving me this formula, this way of understanding things. He said, the leadership council sets policy and directs the pastor. And so I have a boss, and my boss is the leadership council. And so the leadership council gives me direction, and as a pastor, I actually spend most of my time managing our staff. And we have a good amount of staff. We actually have too much staff. Some people working more and some just a handful of hours, but I have too much staff for me to actually have one-on-ones with on a regular basis. I have a calendar, a schedule of what people that I'm mentoring and investing in so that our church staff can then manage the work of the church. Now, what you'll notice here is the next line says that the people do the work of the church. Now, if you don't like this chart, I can give you the name of the anonymous pastor. You can talk with him. No, I'm just kidding. Don't do that. But this is helpful because this is how our church does things. Sometimes every once in a while, I have had a staff member come up and already say, I said, what about, have you asked for volunteers to try to do that, you know, that ministry activity? And I've heard from multiple people say, well, this one person told me it was my job to do. And I thought, oh, that was a little bit of a sassy conversation. But the truth is that we as a church, we don't hire staff people to just do the work as a church. We hire a staff so that together we can be stronger and collaborate and organize and aim our resources and our energy and our time. So as a church, we can make a maximum impact in people's lives and the lives of a community. Now that's actually power that all of you possess. And when you have a mentality that it's a hired staff that does ministry, that's a mentality that's not super healthy, and it doesn't help a church be its best self, because Jesus didn't come to make church staff. Jesus came to make a people change the world together. Staff are just one way to help gather us and set us in a trajectory. Anyways, I thought that was pretty helpful. But I like that because that's actually what the early church did too, is when they sent up the ladder and they had people that they were accountable to in other places. And so let's go back to the first century. We're going back to this debate. And so here's what happened. The council at Jerusalem debated this topic. Who knows how long they talked for, and they heard different testimonies, and they considered this idea, and they knew that somebody was going to be upset no matter what decision they made. And so after this debate, they share some of their results, and then they say this. They summarize it in this right here. They say, therefore, I conclude that we shouldn't create problems for Gentiles who turn to God. That we shouldn't create problems for Gentiles who turn to God. Sure, for some people, this was a question about tradition. It was a question about who we've been in the past. But for the early Christians, they made it about people and who they were trying to reach. See, Jesus didn't leave us a flow chart about how we make decisions. Jesus just left us a contagious, passionate love for outsiders. And that's what Jesus left the early church. And so that's what became the filter that helped them make their decisions. When they had conflict, they put that conflict, they put those different ideas through the filter of their purpose. Another way to put this, and I put it in question format, and it's this. Does this help people or hinder people turning to God? Does this help people or hinder people turning to God? And what if we used a metric like this? What if we used a metric for all of our decisions? Does the decision I'm going to make do X or does it do Y? Because a lot of us do all sorts of different decisions. Does the idea that we have, do all the different directions that we want to go, does it help us accomplish our purposes? Another way that's helped me think about this is by Joanna Gaines, whose TV show I can't continually remember the name of. Joanna Gaines of Chip and Joanna, she ended up writing this book called Homebody. I kind of like design a little bit, and so I was flipping through it, and I was actually looking for this chapter because I read it at Beth's, my girlfriend's sister-in-law's house. And so I actually had Beth, I texted Beth, I'm like, Beth, can you get that, can you have her take a picture of this chapter? And so I ended up typing it out, and I thought it would be helpful for you too. And this is what she wrote. She wrote, this is about her living room. She said, before we moved into the farmhouse. I used to treat my living room the same way a museum curator might handle an exhibition of treasured artifacts. I filled it with only the most beautiful pieces I could find, ones I was sure would look impressive to any guest who might stop by. And then one day, I looked around our living room, and I realized it didn't look anything like our family. Not one of us was represented in this space that was supposed to be central to us living life together. This was a pivotal moment for me as a designer. Of all the rooms that fill a house, perhaps this is the one that should feel most like home to nearly everyone. It should be a soft spot in which to land after a long day. It should carry you through the ebb and flow of life's seasons, molding itself to support your needs. These are the moments that epitomize what home means to me, and they so often happen in the living room. I've never felt so excited about a living room before. For Joanna, she was a designer, and so she was designing her home to impress people, but then she figured out what the purpose of her living room was. And the purpose was not to impress people. The purpose was to live life there. And once she figured out her purpose, then all of the decisions and all of the remaking and reclaiming could be directed towards that purpose. Do you see what happened there? When she figured out the purpose of a space, the decisions then served the purpose and not vice versa. And so you might think, well, purpose is kind of a big topic, Chris. You've already been talking for a long time. Where is this going? Well, I want to do something fun with you guys for a second. And so I want to play a little bit of a game for you. And so I'm going to pull up a slide here. And the slide says this: my purpose is to blank. And I want you to fill this line, not with what you think your purpose should be, but with what you spend most of your time and energy doing. Just think about it for a second. What do I spend most of my time and energy doing? And if you fill this blank and it sounds kind of strange or silly, it's probably not a good purpose for your life. So here's some examples. My purpose is to watch a lot of TV. If it sounds funny, somebody said, I heard a yep from one of the teenagers. I'll fill YouTube in here next. My purpose is to watch a lot of TV. Okay, it sounds a little silly as a life purpose, doesn't it? So maybe that's not a great life purpose. What about this one? My purpose is to obey my spouse. No comment. Next one. All right. My purpose is to complain about politics. Some of you might spend a lot of time, spending time and energy on this. It's a bad purpose for your life. All right, because it sounds funny even saying it. My purpose is to eat. Let me tell you, there are days where this feels like a purpose or a meal I'm really looking forward to. But it sounds funny, doesn't it? It makes you laugh a little bit. It's probably not a great purpose. I forget if I have another. Nope, I got some. So here we go. I'm going to try some other ones. And I want you to look and feel how this feels differently in your gut as you hear this one. My purpose is to use my skills to provide homes for people who can't afford them. This one might not be your job, but it could be a purpose. Do you see how that feels a little different? Here's another one. My purpose is to help challenged kids to read better so they have a better shot at life. Our Village People group, I was told in the last couple weeks, ends up mentoring kids who maybe don't have a great opportunity to learn to read in early childhood. And so we have 10% of our church's attendance actually mentoring kids to read better in their lives and give them a better shot later in life. And all sorts of studies say that what you do in those early years changes the trajectory of your later years. That's something awesome. That is a great purpose. Next one, to serve my family so they see God in my actions. It feels different than the earlier ones. And I think I have another one here. To work hard so that I can give generously to help people. There are people who have that gift of generosity. But this doesn't just work with your lives. Because this is true. If, you know, when you have a purpose, your decisions can help be filtered through that purpose. But it works for a church too. So let's do the same thing. Let's think of some silly things that would be a purpose for a church. How about this one? Host pickleball games. I love pickleball. We have pickleball nights. I think you should join them. It's not a great purpose for a church, is it? It can be an activity we do, but it's not a great purpose. It sounds a little funny. How about this one? Our purpose is to pay utilities for a big building. I know that makes some of you really excited. Actually, we're going to pass another offering plate around. Where's our... All right. pay utility. It's important, but that's not a great purpose. How about this one? Have a room for my Sunday school class. Sunday school classes are important and can help you have a sense of community. Those classrooms are not the purpose of a church, though, are they? It sounds a little funny. But there are some other ways, things that make us feel a little more important. How about this one? Our purpose is to help families grow stronger. We live more and more in a society where it's more and more challenging for families to stick together and to stay together and to grow strong and to head in a shared direction. How about this one? Our purpose is to help feel God through music. Our bands up here are not the point, but they sure help us encounter God in new ways. How about this one? Our purpose is to help kids grow up to be faithful adults. You saw the kids that were up here singing. That we don't just want those kids in here because we like looking at children. We believe that you can impact a kid's life or a teenager's life. And what happens at those ages will impact the trajectory of their lives. And guys, I don't know if you know this, but the kind of youth row sitting over here, you don't even know this, but you have a whole church who admires you and loves you. And if we don't tell you enough, that's on us, but we do. And we want the best for you. And so you may not know it, but you have a whole group of people who are your fan club. So anyways, that's a good one. All right. Our purpose is to give people hope through faith in Christ. There are more and more people out there who are trying to hold on through all sorts of stuff going on in life, and a church who's got its purpose figured out can reach out and invite people in for a little bit of trajectory and purpose and hope in their lives. That is a lot different than necessarily just putting on church services. So I share all of this because if this is our living room, before we can reclaim and renovate it, we have to know what we're reclaiming and renovating it for. Another question might be, before we can reclaim it and renovate it, we have to know who we're reclaiming and renovating it for. And the answer, if I'm totally honest with you, is we don't have this yet. One of the first questions I asked our leadership council when I met them months before starting is I said, what is our purpose as a church? And the answer was, we need to figure this out. Because we don't have language and trajectory. We don't have this filter to say, like the first Jerusalem council that said, we're going to make decisions because for us, we don't want to make it hard for people to turn to God. And so every decision we make goes through that filter. And so what about us? What about the unique way that God uses us? What thing can all of us stack hands on and agree on it and take all of our different ideas and help them point in the same direction? And so I'm working with our leadership council, and we want to come up with a pathway forward, a method forward, like a roadmap of what it looks like for our church to reflect and share and pray and try to say, how do we put language to what we're about? What's the unique expression that God's going to do through us and through this church? And that's the first part of our journey. We need to figure out what that metric is, because then all the decisions we make can be funneled through that and help us, just like Joanna and just like the first church, realize the purpose of what we're renovating. So I want to end with this. This is what I love about church. There might be 32,000 different denominations, but I don't think that means that people are confused or that's wrong. I just think that God uses different churches in different ways. And so we have the challenge of finding out what's the unique expression that God is going to use us for. That we have broken people with a billion different ideas of where we're going, and God can unify us for a purpose that's bigger than any one of us. I'm excited for God, how God's going to use us, and I'm excited for how God will uniquely use you. Would you pray with me? God, thank you for loving us. Thank you for sending your son to help us have a love for you and a love for others. And God, when we get a bunch of people in our community, when we get a bunch of people in a room, it's so challenging for us to stack hands, to head in one direction. And so God, give us patience and wisdom and insight and unity so that together we can accomplish more than any one of us could accomplish by ourselves. God, help this be a church that just eagerly seeks your will for us, and help us to put language to the reason you've put us here. In your holy name we pray.